Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Anoush.
And on this week's New Statesman podcast,
we talk about vote leave spending.
We grapple with sound difficulties.
And we ask whether there's any truth in the accusation that the anti-Semitism row is a smear.
And we discuss dodgy leaflets in Havering. So this week and also last week's big political story, I guess, are the ongoing revelations about the activity, or the alleged activities of Cambridge Analytica in the referendum campaign. Chris Wylie, one of the people who helped build the software, said in his Commons Select Committee appearance that he believed, and given the decisive margin, the narrow margin, that cheating, in his words, on the part of the Leave campaigns had been vital to the result. Yeah, so I think that's obviously the kind of biggest ongoing political story, and it has a lot of facets. So
yeah, it does, and I love... You know, lots of people like to talk about the machinations of these shady data companies. But what people really care about this story is they want to believe that the EU referendum result is illegitimate. Isn't that? That's why people are interested in it. There is a privacy argument, and we don't know whether or not Aggregate IQ, which is the company that's implicated in this vote leave scandal that has links to Cambridge Analytica, has done what the whistleblowers accuse it of doing. But the big question is for people, particularly those on the Remain side of things, is whether or not these activities and the alleged overspending of the Vote Leave campaign meant that the result was ill-gotten. And that's why people care. That's what I think.
Yeah, I think it's one of those stories where there are three undercurrents to it, two which I think are legitimate, one which you correctly identified as, which I think is illegitimate, which is there is a group of people, and I say this as someone who is, you know, one too many bottles of red wine or whatever from launching my own centrist party late at night to stop Brexit, who do basically seem to think that Brexit is something, and if they are like sufficiently angrily middle class about it, eventually their lawyers will fix it. You know, like it's kind of like, oh, it's a minor speed bump which we can somehow like sue our way out of.
Yeah.
And there is a group of people for whom that is the attraction of this story. Then there are the serious allegations. You know, someone on Twitter put it well, they said, I don't think that Cambridge Analytica are anywhere near as influential as they have pretended to be and are now claiming not to be. However, if you break the law, right, if you say, oh yeah, we can procure a honey trap, as they were caught on camera saying in the Channel 4 series, then you deserve to be investigated, right? Like, ultimately, if there are many reasons I would be unable to pull off a bank heist. But if I tried to pull off a bank heist, then I ought to be held. And I think, yeah, that's sort of a legitimate one. And then there's the kind of broader sign of, I know I said there were two legitimate ones, but there's a broader one which I would say is semi-legitimate, which is about the ways that the Leave campaign tried to maximise the effectiveness of money to get around rules about how the referendum campaign worked. And the reason why I say that is semi-legitimate is that does, in my view, expose the serious problems with UK election law. However, I simply am yet to see a persuasive case that there was not cheating, that there was not sufficient cheating on both sides to make it moot, right? It's a bit like, yeah, it was a 2-1 victory, but if the remain, if the goal you scored in the one goal you scored was offside, and their winning goal was from a dodgy penalty, well, ultimately you still lost by one legitimate goal.
Yeah. Yeah, and really, you know, if it does turn out to be true, if the allegations are from this activist called Shamir Sani, who claims that Vote Leave were exceeding the spending limit of £7 million that they had. If it does turn out to be true, what they were doing or what they are accused of doing is giving extra money to a separate campaign organisation called Believe, but telling them how to spend it, then, you know, that would be breaking our election spending law. But how different morally would it be from the Remain campaign having other resources of funding, not least, you know, the government being on their side and the two main political parties? They were campaigning for the Remain. They had the money, and those didn't count towards the official Remain campaign spending limit.
Yeah, I mean, this is ultimately, I think, any conversation about referendum spending does have to acknowledge. I mean, I think the £9 million leaflet that the government sent was entirely counterproductive. I mean, it wasn't, obviously, the worst mistake that George Osborne and David Cameron made was not treating the 2016 budget as a pre-election one. But and one of a series of catastrophic mistakes made by Cameron and Osborne in that referendum campaign.
Definitely, yeah.
However, that doesn't... That's one of those things where, like again... There are two separate issues here, and I think you're completely right to separate the morality from the legality, right? Morally, there is no difference between, you know, if I'm a wealthy pro-Remainer, sadly only one of those facts is true, and I decide to give £1 million to the Lib Dems, which I earmark for them to only use for the referendum, £1 million to Labour, which I earmark for them to only use for referendum, and then £1 million to the Remain campaign, and there are donors who did this, I've acted within the law. However, in terms of what election spending limits are meant to prevent, I cannot see an argument that that is not equally problematic. I mean, not least because the Remain campaigns and the League campaigns did all coordinate, you know, they did all talk to one another, and that was legally fine. Now, admittedly, if you break a law, and this is probably a good opportunity to widen it to the wider problems with UK election law. So, you know, so to take like the recent Conservative election spending campaign, basically all political parties who compete in multiple constituencies find ways to leverage their national spend into their local spend and vice versa. It may be that the Conservatives did so in ways which broke the letter of the law. However, you simply cannot argue, unless you are, like, you know, a frothing partisan, that the other parties have not found ways to break
exactly
the spirit of the law.
Which is why during or after the 2015 election, sort of local Conservative Party being accused of overspending and being investigated for it and then being fined for it, that's why you saw very little said on the Labour side. You know, you didn't have much Tory election fraud from Labour politicians, because they know that they try and do very similar things in their constituencies. I know that you were particularly interested in the way that Jeremy Corbyn used TV while he was campaigning before the 2017 election.
So one of the really clever things they did was a lot of their rallies were in very safe seats, which either bordered or shared an ITV or BBC media region with marginal seats. Now, obviously, there are a couple of advantages of holding your rally in a safe seat. The first of which is, of course, that you are not touching your important local spend in your key battles. The second, of course, is if you are Jeremy Corbyn and you hold a rally in... I'm having a geography fail, so I'm just going to pretend that there's like an ultra marginal seat next to Hackney where I live. This marginal of Swingington Central. ultimately, if you hold your rally in neighbouring Hackney, a bunch of happy people who want to see Corbyn will turn up. The photos and film will look great, but it will be transmitted to televisions in Swingington Central. And that is perfectly legal. I actually think that is morally different, whereas many of the things that the Labour Party does in terms of maximising its election spending are not. But it is an example of something Labour did well that most people didn't notice, but also an example of a pattern of behaviour which exposes the big lie of our election campaigns, which is we do not have 650 campaigns. I know that every time I go on about people not having a personal vote, people start laughing. However, it is nonetheless true. People's personal votes are derisory. So this, and the fact that we have an election law based around the idea that there are 650 unconnected races in which people go like, I wonder which one of my doughty local representatives I'm going to send to Parliament is ripe for abuse. We need, you know, a new election spending and hopefully also, you know, real electoral reform.
Yeah, and the difference between national and local spending is becoming increasingly arbitrary, isn't it? I mean, This Cambridge Analytica stuff has sparked a debate about how much what we see on Facebook and online can influence the way that we vote. And nowhere is this more obvious than in our election law, where you have all of the main parties and their non-official organisations that support them putting loads of stuff out on social media that is micro-targeted, obviously, to individual constituencies, so this, which comes into the national spend, or doesn't even go into that because it's by momentum, which doesn't have to account its national spend under the Labour Party. It has a separate cap.
Yeah, this is the hilarious thing with Facebook, is if I am a political party and I decide and I want my Facebook ads to only be seen by people in the West Midlands, an area that's full of marginals, that is national spend only by the most tendentious of means. And yeah, it is a nonsense idea. You know, people just do not and have never consumed news in that way. I mean, I think it is obviously true that adverts change people's minds, right? That's why people spend so much money on them. That's why if you're a good advertiser, you know, you can earn so much money, right? Mm. However, one of the things I found slightly weird about some of the coverage of the Cambridge Analytica adverts they've made is this weird way you'd see an advert and you're just like, yeah, but that appeared, you know, something that bitterly partisan appears on the pages of any of our tabloids, or any of the alt-left blogs, you know, any. Mm. But yeah, it's this slight weirdness, and like if you say something untrue in a right-wing tabloid and it's been around for 100 years, you're a respectable member of the political establishment. Yeah. If you say something flatly untrue on like a rando left-wing blog and it's been around for 3 years, you are deeply pernicious. Now, I think they're both deeply pernicious, but this weird idea in like, well, because this one is new, it's bad, whereas this has been bad for 100 years, so it's part of the fabric of public life or some nonsense. I do think there are probably accountability problems.
Yeah, definitely. I was speaking to the Electoral Commission earlier this week for a piece that I was writing, and they were saying that they've asked Parliament to update the election spending rules to make sure that there are imprints on adverts that go out online, videos, you know, tweeted pledge cards that say where they're from, whether they're from an official party or whether they're from another non-party campaign organisation. Because at the moment we have this weird situation where you can get leaflets through your door and they've got all that sort of small print at the bottom saying this was printed on, you know, in room 72 of this Conservative local association. Whereas online, everything you see that's political, there's no requirement for them to put any imprint on it. So that makes it, I think that is bad and that should change, because it makes things misleading for voters. It can be confusing and, like you say, unaccountable.
Yeah, I also think one of the problems with the kind of gradual decline of kind of the shared public sphere where we all consume news together, which I mean, thanks to the fact that radio is still incredibly popular, is not as marked as you would necessarily think. But I mean, I have a number of friends who are conservative who did not vote for Zach Goldsmith in 2016 because they did not like the campaign that he ran. They had been planning to vote for Zach Goldsmith at the start of the campaign. Now, it's very easy to see how in 10 years' time, everyone watches TV on demand, everyone exists in a social media bubble that is curated to keep them there and to keep them happy. You have, I'm Zach Goldsmith, I hump trees in those friends in those friends of mine's Facebook. And then you have, I'm Zach Goldsmith. No, and then you have, even with an imprint, you then have Sadiq Khan is a scary jihadi who's going to sell your gold or steal your gold. He was going to do something creepy to people's gold. And then imprint paid for by Zach Goldsmith. Now, if the first group, if the people who the tree advert is targeted are never in a position to see or know that the scary jihadi advert exists, that I think does have problems for political accountability.
Yeah.
But the weird thing is that is the bit that Vote Leave did very well and wasn't illegal. They did an awful lot of, like, you know, have your liberal Brexit, have your protectionist Brexit. You know, if you don't like those Brexits, don't worry, those are other Brexits.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to see how you can prevent that without running into quite serious freedom of expression worries.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
So now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
And Anoush, you have a question from when you were covering the protests about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party on Monday.
Yes, I had a tweeted question saying, is there any truth in the argument that these accusations are a smear?
So my short and immediate answer is no, because there are real incidences of virulent and unacceptable anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, and the Labour Party has been sluggish about dealing with them, to put it mildly. In fact, I think sluggish is too kind. The Labour Party has been, you know, just utterly abject at dealing with anti-Semitism in its ranks. However, it is nonetheless true to say that there is a large group of people who do not give a flying one about the issue, who are willing to talk about the issue because they don't like the Labour Party. However, I just think, I mean, one, that is not true of the majority of people who are raising the issue. But actually, if you say something and five people say they're offended and one person is someone who's genuinely upset about it, who's from that minority group, and the other four are just people who don't like you and want you having a hard time, well, the four people do not give you a license to ignore the concerns of the fifth. And actually, in this case, the margin is completely the other way, right?
Yeah, exactly. I do often find that argument, well, some people are doing it for political purposes. Well, of course they are. This is politics. It's sort of irrelevant in a way, because there are people who are genuinely upset about it and offended by it. And if Jewish community leaders, you know, are sort of having to start these extraordinary sort of rallies outside Parliament, you know, I was speaking to one person who was 18, a student who was Jewish, who was saying, this is my first ever political protest I've been to. He really looked devastated that he had to be standing outside Parliament in 2018 with a banner saying stop denying the Holocaust. I mean, it is extraordinary. And what really, really made me think about this smear question was the small counter protest at the anti-Semitism rally in Parliament Square. Lots of them, you know, are Jewish themselves, and I did interview them and I listened to what they had to say and read their banners. And what they were saying was, you know, this is timed just before the local elections to undermine Jeremy Corbyn by people in the Labour Party who just don't want him to be their leader. And what really surprised me was that actually Jeremy Corbyn had put out a statement just a couple of hours before saying that he's admitting that the party had been too slow to address the anti-Semitic comments and smears and tropes that had been issued by people in the Labour Party, and they hadn't expelled them quick enough. And, you know, he did give that apology. So he was admitting that this issue is real, whereas the people out sort of batting for him at this campaign weren't. And that really made me think, okay, people have slightly lost the reality of the situation here.
Yeah. It is also true, and I say this as, you know, an outside but long-time observer of the Labour Party, it is also true to say that anti-Semitism has been a problem in the Labour Party for a long time, since before the 12th of September 2015. However, it is also true that it has been a problem that has, you know, not exclusively, you know, concentrated in all factions of Labour, but has been given particular house room in the part of the Labour Party from which Jeremy Corbyn emanates. However, and, you know, actually, this is something, and some of the people who've been very critical of Corbyn, you know, some MPs who've been very critical of Corbyn over anti-Semitism privately will say, oh, I think I shouldn't have turned a blind eye to this when, you know, there were things about the Labour Party I didn't, you know, it's easier to go, come on, you need to tackle this, when it's a leader you're not sympathetic to, than it was, you know, like, ultimately, like, no one in a leadership position in the Labour Party saw fit to tackle the fact that Jeremy Corbyn commented under a defense of, like, a racist mural going, I don't see the problem here. As it happens, I believe Corbyn's second statement that he just didn't look and dashed off a response. I think that is actually the real problem that the Labour left has, is that it basically regards anti-Semitism as something which happens from outside the walls of the Labour Party.
Yeah.
When it happens, it's like a weird aberration, and it doesn't need to be on the lookout for it. But ultimately, right, that mural was defended by Jeremy Corbyn under the previous Labour leadership, and the then Labour leadership did nothing about it.
Yeah.
And you can find example and example after under previous Labour leaders. But yeah, it basically say ultimately that is secondary to the fact that it is a problem and it should be tackled. It is, however, true, and we will discuss, I think, in the next section, of course, there are things in the other party, as it were, that are also not tackled. And unlike this, aren't even addressed publicly by a minority of their own MPs. Gosh, I realize this is kind of a depressing week because it's been a week with two racism scandals in our major political parties. The second of which is a leaflet by the Havering Conservatives. Could you talk us through this leaflet, please?
Yeah, so with the local election campaigns kicking off last week, this leaflet started to emerge on social media, as we were discussing in the previous section. No leaflet's a secret anymore. And it's from the Romford Conservatives Local Association. It was distributed around Havering, and it's a newsletter, and it uses very sort of what I would call dog whistle, racially charged sort of implied language. So it says, we don't want Havering to turn into Hackney, Newham and other areas of East London, which have large non-white populations. And it says that Union Jacks would be pulled down if the Labour Party is voted in during the local elections. And then it warns Haringey residents that they will be ruled under Mayor Khan, which was a particular favourite of mine because he is already in charge of London. So Mayor Khan rules, yeah. rules large.
It's like bad news, guys. Yeah. London has fallen. This was an explicitly, you know, I mean, it's one of those who's just like, is this even signalling, or is this just basically an explicitly inflammatory? And it's not the first time that Conservative MPs have participated in campaigning against Sadiq Khan that has been of this nature. Nadine Dorries recently tweeted something like, why is Sadiq Khan focusing on either housing or transport? He should be focusing on grooming in Telford. Now, you did a very good interview with someone who prosecutes grooming cases. They are undoubtedly very serious. However, Sadiq Khan is not politically involved in Telford. Ultimately, you can make I think, quite strong argument that the mayor should have greater powers over policing than they have, but you literally can't. There is not a non-dog whistle reason for that tweet.
No, exactly. You know why she sent that tweet is because he's a Muslim of Pakistani.
Yeah, like, you know, Conservative MPs have shared, you know, Britain First memes about knife crime in the capital and Sadiq Khan. Knife crime in the capital is going up, however, it's going up less than the national average. And it, you know, has quite a lot to do with, you know, cuts in policing and many other things, which are, again, not within the control of the Mayor of London. And the interesting thing is, inspired by two people, the Conservative peer Andrew Cooper, who very publicly condemned both of these things, and Sundar Katwala, head of the think tank British Future, which is about the fact that, you know, as Britain changes, we will become more diverse and what that means for politics. Sundar Katwala said, you know, and I thought it was a really interesting idea, he said what he'd like to do is to have to keep track of which MPs do the following. One, MPs who only ever talk about racism on their own side. Mm-hmm. So they only use it as a stick to beat their party leadership with. Two, MPs who only ever talk about racism on the other side. And three, MPs who only ever talk about racism in order to defend their own party from accusations of racism. One of the things I'm glad that we have done this week is we have not discussed Havering in reference to Labour's anti-Semitism problem. Mm. And we're not, because ultimately it felt this week, and a lot of parties seem to think that racism is like first past the post, where it's like, oh, but we're, I have literally seen people arguing, oh, Labour has an anti-Semitism problem, but, you know, it's not as bad, or it's only as bad as the Conservatives' Muslim problem. It's just like, guys, this is not a competition.
Yeah, they're both problems. Yeah, and just, that's the problem. Nick Bowles, the Tory MP and former minister, he tweeted about the Havering leaflet saying that it was, you know, disgraceful. And then at the end of his tweet, he said, how can we expect to sort of attack Labour on anti-Semitism when we have this in our own party? It was a bit like, there's nothing. Yeah, it's nothing to do with, I mean, it. Maybe oppose both.
It's one of those things where also it's like, It is true that you can't, with a straight face, say this prejudice is bad,
yeah,
while engaging in it in your own house. However, that's not the, yeah, like, the reason not to do it is not because your attack line will fall flat. The interesting thing is, so I inspired by Sundar's question, I started doing myself, and you've slightly stolen my punchline, which is, right, it turns out there is literally one Conservative MP. I was going to invite listeners to guess, but I guess particularly stupid listeners could still try and guess. The one MP who has, in the Conservative side, who has criticised both his party and another party publicly for racist campaigning is Nick Bowles. Mm-hmm. Whereas basically every Labour MP with a significant social media platform, so I'm discounting the ones who only tweet things like, thrilled to open my local cabbage factory in Margington South. All of the ones who have a more significant social media platform than that have condemned Zach Goldsmith. Obviously, most of those MPs have not condemned the moat in their own eye, aka Labour's anti-Semitism problem.
Yeah.
However, no MP who has condemned Labour for anti-Semitism has not also condemned Zach Goldsmith's campaign. However, I believe I am right, and I haven't voted. John Speller is the only one who has not condemned anyone for subsequent campaigning against Sadiq Khan. So, I mean...
Right, okay.
And I do think it reveals an interesting cultural difference between the two parties, because there are many Conservative MPs who believe Zach Goldsmith's campaign was out of line. However, well, only one of them has seen fit to say anything about it. And ultimately, these two things shouldn't be compared or weighed against each other, because they are both bad and both parties need to fix them. And that is, you know, like it really is irritating when people go like, oh, you know, we wouldn't act the way that Labour does towards concerns in the Jewish community, towards concerns women have in political parties. It's like, I mean, we're literally right now finding out the extent to which we have, do, and still are doing that. So perhaps we... perhaps we should just acknowledge it's a problem and it should be tackled. Like.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the Conservatives being, you're right, they were silent throughout Zach Goldsmith's campaign. And then after he lost, a few people came out, but not, you know, not high profile. No, hardly any MPs, I don't think.
Well, and, you know, Kemi Badenoch
gave
an interview with The Standard recently, which he went, oh, no, actually, like, what he was really saying was that Sadiq Khan's judgment was faulty. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah, I know, they really haven't... And actually, this isn't to their advantage, because they do have... Well, I mean, I interviewed Saeed Avasi, a Tory peer who used to be in government last year, and she'd brought out a book which has some really interesting things about how the sort of Tory high command saw courting Muslim voters when she was in those conversations. And really, she was saying, and it's her accusation, that they kind of... they've calculated that they didn't really need the Muslim vote, so they were going to try and maximise the vote of other communities, other ethnic minority communities, seeing them as sort of a future potential sort of part of their voter base. And so what she said was that Theresa May had sort of lost Muslim voters by carrying on this complacent attitude towards them. And you can see that happening in the Zach Goldsmith campaign and with leaflets like the Havering one, which wasn't explicitly about Muslims, but it was about areas with high Asian Muslim communities.
Yeah. And I think actually the problem is it's the slight, you know, one of the many tragedies of Labour's anti-Semitism problem is that ultimately the electoral damage they will suffer from it, they can walk off.
Yeah.
However, the electoral damage that the Conservatives' race problem has does place a semi-permanent block on how you can see them getting a decent-ish parliamentary majority ever again. So it's actually more acute, obviously. Whether or not your problem is electorally relevant is not really the issue here.
Yeah.
But it does make it even more interesting that they don't talk about it.
Exactly.
Because one of the reasons why Parliament's become a lot more women-friendly is Tory and Labour women work together all the time on those issues. Fascinatingly, despite the fact we have more ethnic minorities in Parliament than ever before, I think, that still doesn't seem to happen.
Yeah, and that's precisely their problem. They won't talk about it, so then it will become an electoral problem for them. Not that that is... the at the heart of the issue, but you'd think that that would be at least one motive.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague Anusha Kellyan. It's recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our music is Devil by the Devil and is licensed under Creative Commons. We're sorry about some of the sound difficulties you may have experienced listening to this week's New Statesman podcast. We are working on a solution. Something that has been solved is the sign-up page for my free morning email. So if you haven't got on that yet, now's the time to start.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.